As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Be the best and you got to pay a little price. If you want it bad enough, you got to do a little extra things to get it.
Welcome to the 11 Personnel Podcast, your favorite Rams podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Rodrigue, and with me, as always, my fabulous co-host, Rich Hammond. Rich, how we doing?
Jordan, we are doing well. I'm excited, because we don't have guests very often, and that's by design. We don't just want to put anybody on our podcast, right? I mean, it has to be something special. And I'm very excited about this. We're going to talk about a great book, first of all, but a piece of history, football history, sports history, and specifically Los Angeles sports history. So let's get going.
Yeah, so excited about this. Today we are talking to the two co-authors of the book Hail Mary, The Rise and Fall of the National Women's Football League. This book was co-written by Brittany Della Creta and Lindsay D'Arcangelo. We know their work. We love their work. I obsessively follow both of these writers. Really, really phenomenal stuff. Learned so much and just about writing and life and everything in between from both of these two writers. Brittany, I'm going to read the back page. If you guys don't mind, I want to gas you up a little bit here. So Brittany writes on the intersection of sports, culture, and gender. Their work has appeared in the New York Times, Sports Illustrated, ESPNW, the Washington Post, The Atlantic, and more. Again, Twitter follows. This is where you find their work. And they just do extraordinary work in the lens of, you know, this is a book about women's history and football, women in football history, and the sort of little documented history of that. But they do work in spaces that reach far beyond the lens of what we normally see in sports. And it's super important. Make sure you go give them a follow. Lindsay D'Arcangelo writes about women's college basketball and the WNBA for Just Women's Sports and The Athletic. Her articles, columns, and profiles on female LGBTQ on female and LGBTQ plus athletes have appeared in The Ringer, Deadspin, ESPNW, ESPN, Teen Vogue, Huffington Post, NBC Out, and more. Thank you both for joining us today. I hope you didn't mind that I read your back page. I wanted everyone to know just how phenomenal you both are. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
So this book, I can only imagine what an undertaking writing Hail Mary was. Not just because of the magnitude and importance of the subject, but also because there is so little that is known about this, I think probably in what you would classify as sort of the mainstream sports zeitgeist. And there was so little documented about it as it was happening. So can you take us through first the process of writing this book, which, by the way, everyone, you can pick up at most booksellers. I found mine at Barnes & Noble, even though we do say go support your local booksellers in your communities. But what was the process like and how did this book sort of come to be? And what were the things that stood out to both of you as you went about the research process?
I can talk a little bit about how we stumbled upon this story. Lindsay and I became friends through just, you know, sports writing communities on social media. And I know a lot less about football than Lindsay does. So whenever my work would bump up against football, I would always be like pinging Lindsay and running things by her. And we had an idea for a book about women's football history that was much broader than this. It kind of covered all aspects of the game on and off the field. And we put together a book proposal on that, and it didn't sell because it didn't have enough of a narrative arc, we were told. But in the process of researching that book, I came across the Toledo Troopers, who I'm sure we'll talk more about. And they are the winningest team in pro football history, men's or women's. And in looking them up and trying to learn more about them, there's, you know, some stuff out there, but I realized there was all of these teams that they were playing. And I was kind of like, well, who are these teams? And we really couldn't find much. And I think it became really clear to Lindsay and I pretty quickly that this was the book that we needed to write. Mm-hmm. And then that opened up the research question, which I don't know if Lindsay wants to talk more about that.
Yeah. So basically what we did, we split the teams between each other. And then we just kind of dug in and really, really went full on into reading old newspaper articles, you know, just that's kind of where we gathered all of our initial information. And once we started finding articles about teams and players, we were able to get names, and then we'd take those names and do some research and some Facebook stalking. All of these women right now are in their mid-60s to early 70s. So, you know, a lot of them aren't, you know, tech savvy. So it took a lot of just blind messaging and cold calls, introducing ourselves, getting them comfortable and trusting enough in believing who we were, who we said we were, and were really legitimate into this project. And just one by one, once we started talking to different players, they would tell their teammates, and it just sort of kind of unrolled from there. But yeah, the research itself was kind of just, you know, little by little, things started unfolding, and then it would lead us to something else, and then something else, another player. And they had a bunch of memorabilia that they have saved over the years, from ticket stubs to game programs to jerseys to pictures. We got to see a lot of stuff from that era and from the time that they played, and that helped a lot, giving us visuals and just more familiarity with the players. But yeah, that's basically how we sort of put it all together.
You know, something that was interesting to me, and the book certainly delivers on its title, which is Hail Mary, the Rise and Fall of the National Women's Football League. So there's plenty of narrative in there about the league itself. But the two of you get into such amazing detail about these players. And these are people who, for various reasons, we don't know very much about if you're a casual football fan. And you really take us inside their lives, who they are as people, who they were as athletes, which is extraordinary. There's so many great anecdotes in there about these people. But Lindsay, you hinted just a moment ago about maybe some reluctance. And I know that was mentioned a couple times in the book about how maybe they were concerned about being interviewed at all, or they were concerned about how they were going to be portrayed, or who might be talked about in the book. Why do you think that there was some reluctance there? It seemed like some people were very willing to come out and share, but others, maybe you had to coax a little bit out of them. What were their feelings on that? I'm sure it wasn't universal, but what were some of the things that you encountered in terms of trying to get them to tell their stories?
Well, I think part of that goes back to how they were treated largely by the media in the night, and, you know, during the time that they played, which is the early 1970s. And just how, you know, the kinds of questions they were asked, and that I think had more of an impact, a lasting impact. But for me personally, the player that I struggled the most with just getting her to kind of trust and open up was Rose Lowe. And she actually played for the LA Dandelions. Mm-hmm. She was the team captain. She was very instrumental in the team, very supportive, just has done a lot over the years to keep all the teammates in touch. And I had spoken to a couple of her teammates and they kept saying, you've got to talk to Rose. You got to talk to Rose. She saved everything. She knows everything about the team. So I emailed her to no response. And then one of the players gave her my telephone number. We ended up exchanging a couple of text messages initially. She was kind of feeling me out. And then we had an initial phone call where I really felt like she was vetting me, you know, just to get a sense that I was really who I said I was, and that Brittany and I were going to handle her story and the larger story of the NWFL with care. And once she realized that I was on the up and up and that our intentions were good, we scheduled the phone chat for an interview, and it just went from there. And she sent me a package full. I mean, really, a lot of this book would have been incomplete had it not been for some of the documents that she supplied to us, and some of the photographs and just additional information. It was just like a treasure trove. It was so great. And then, you know, we had multiple conversations throughout the process. She ended up sending me care packages throughout the writing process. Yeah. When we completed the book, she sent me a little gift and then sent something to Brittany as well. And she's just become, she's done a complete 180. She's now very protective of us. When our fact checker was going through the book and had to call different players to just check on some stuff, he called her and she messaged me right away and was like, who's this guy who's double checking on you? And I had to tell her it was all good. But yeah, that's a great example of just somebody who just really holds this time in her life so close to her heart and was protecting it, you know, as best as she could. And just really came around and just it's her sharing her story. I just feel so privileged, not only with her, but with everyone we spoke to.
And question for you both too, some of the detail in here, and again, to our listeners, I want to make sure that this is presented in the proper context here, because there is so little, first of all, there's so little reasonable documentation of this period, you know, the period through the 1970s, but also what precedented sort of this league, that it's when I'm reading this, I'm dog-earing the pages and underlining things like details about in earlier than the league itself. You know, the LA Times is out literally covering one of these sort of women's scrimmages, and you guys have a detail in there about a woman who is a barefoot punter who punts the ball barefoot. And yet it's almost like a masterful way of juxtaposing the detail that you were able to find with what ended up being the coverage of the event itself, which was so reductive and insulting, frankly. And I wonder in that throughout that process, and this question for both of you, as you're bridging those gaps and finding those details, and with Rose Lowe, you know, the detail of how she flips her hair up under her helmet and these types of things, as you're finding these details, but then also juxtaposing them with the actual coverage of the time, what was that process for you? Not just sifting through all of that, but also almost deprocessing it yourselves.
I think that for us, there was no way to write this book without just facing the coverage head on of what existed. And I think we were really thoughtful in the way we structured this book too. When you read this book, we open, you know, smack in the middle of the NWFL's season. You open basically in gameplay. The entire first part of the book really documents play-by-play action and gameplay. Mm-hmm. And that was really intentional for us. We get into the character backstories later and you really learn who these teams and these people were, but their skill was mocked and doubted so much when they were playing. And even today, the idea that women could be good, legitimate football players is still kind of mocked. And so for us, we never wanted the reader to doubt that these women were football players and that they had the skill and ability to be on the field, which is why you meet them in gameplay first. You meet them as athletes, and then we can go back and like dive into the context and the larger backstory, because we really wanted to center that that's who they were and this is what they did. And that was, you know, in part a response to the coverage that we were, you know, slogging through. Lindsay and I were sending these things back and forth to each other while we were researching, because it was really shocking to see really just how degrading and demeaning and sexist the media coverage of these women really was. And I know Lindsay also wrote a lot of the chapter in the book that deals with the media coverage and those stereotypes. So I don't know if you have anything you want to add about that, Linz.
Well, I'm sure we'll get into that more, but I just want to touch on Jordan's comment about the little details that we added to personalize these players. Like we wanted you to get to know them and as though they were their old friends. And so adding these little touches, I think, was key in doing that.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for the Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Yeah, I want to circle back to some of that coverage that you were talking about, and even how teams kind of struggled with that a little bit. But by way of getting into that, want to talk about the history a little bit, and especially the history as it pertains to Los Angeles, because there is some amazing stuff in here that I just did not know. And some of this is just because of the dates of it. I'm old, but I'm not quite old enough to have lived through some of these times. So it was a fascinating history lesson to go through it. But even going farther back, and we're talking about the 1970s here, but you even go back to the late 1800s and talking about the first documented game of women's football back when it was 5-on-5. You go back to 1939 when you discovered the first full contact game was actually played in Los Angeles. And then you fast forward. Well, you don't fast forward. I'm fast forwarding for the purposes of our conversation. conversation to the early 1970s, and a man named Bob Matthews, who's a brother of owners of another team, who decided to found, I guess you would say, the L.A. Dandelions in Southern California. Why the Dandelions, you say? Because Matthews' wife described them as pretty spring flowers that you just can't kill. I really I liked that. That was something that I made a note of. But the history of this league, very, very deep roots in Los Angeles, right? And I don't know, that probably wasn't by design, but how did that come to be that so much of this history of this league kind of runs through this area?
Well, I think mostly it runs through Ohio's really the thread, right?
Sure.
Where this all began. If you go back to before the NWFL started, you had a man named Sid Friedman, who was from Cleveland, Ohio. He was a promoter and a sports agent, quote unquote, because some of that could be questioned. But he really saw women's football starting to take hold, this like novelty, this curiosity. And as you mentioned, we document throughout history different times when women have played or had tried to play, and how it was short-lived or how it had gotten represented, or at schools when they tried to form teams or did, and how it didn't last. So leading up to that, he sort of was looking for the next big thing, and he decided to start a women's football troop, kind of like the Harlem Globetrotters, and have them go around and play men's teams, you know, for a ticketed event where he could make some money. And what he found is when he put together a team is that there were some really talented women on that team and they could really play. Mm-hmm. And he eventually, you know, formed some other teams. He never got a full up running league off the ground, but he had his group of teams. And, you know, there's a tie there because the Toledo Troopers, who are the winningest team in football history, actually, not just a women's league, but they were under his group of teams before they left and joined the NWFL. But back to your question, as far as LA is concerned, you know, that game that where you talked about the barefooted punter, you know, mm-hmm. that happened in the 1930s, and it blows people's mind. It even blew ours, you know, doing all this research and finding all these incidents of women playing football and, you know, doing it well, but never just fully getting the opportunity to really take it as far as it maybe could have gone. And to see the league sort of start because the owner of the LA Dandelions really wanted to legitimize the game and the sport for women is really a cool thing. And, you know, Bob Matthews saw what his brother was doing in Dallas with the Dallas Blue Bonnets and just saw some other teams around the leagues and thought, you know what, maybe let's give this a go. Maybe his intention and the intention of the owners at the time was to start something akin to the NFL and have it grow and be as popular. But obviously that didn't happen. But yeah, the intention was there, and the idea to really give these women a chance to have the opportunity to play a sport that they loved was sincere.
I think it's interesting too, when you both, of course, do this so well, where the reader understands the juxtaposition of these two figures and how, yes, both were very important in the context of women's football in terms of the structures they created via these leagues and all of that. But they also were so different in terms of perhaps their intention overall, and then also the way that they went about trying to make this happen. And I felt that you showed the reader two very different methodologies and how they ultimately met results that I wouldn't say the same results, but results that were similar because they met pitfalls that were similar, but they met them and approached them in different ways. And I'm wondering if you can take us through those two characters, you know, Bob Matthews and Sid Friedman, and their, I think, vast differences. But again, you guys, you were the ones who did the research on this, but also, you know, ultimately the rich communities that stemmed from both of these, you know, varying types of structures, league structures. We'll get into that in a minute, but I am so curious about how you've delved into these characters and then recognized their differences and probably some of their similarities as well, and how that also played a part in shaping these leagues.
Yeah, so we both got to know these men through different ways. I covered LA Dandelions was my team. And so I got the history and how it all came about with that specific team and Bob Matthews as well. And then I did the history leading up to the start of the NWFL, the research for that and the writing for that. And so I got to know Sid Freeman as well. Brittany got to know Sid Freeman through covering the Toledo Troopers and mm-hmm. that whole interaction, which Brittany can jump on in here after I explain a little bit about my side and my view. I think they are both a part of women's football history. They're both an integral part, but they're, like you said, Jordan, two very different men who had two very different types of motivation. Sid Freeman was in it to make money, and like it or not, he's without him, I don't know that the NWFL would have started when it did, or even had the launching pad for it at that time. So he's crucial to that, but he was never in it to really grow the sport and, create an equal playing field for women. That just wasn't part of his intention. And he also didn't mind the negative press from the media. You know, as a promoter, he felt that any press was good press, and he, you know, it was going to get it however he could get it, making outlandish statements, as I'm sure you read throughout the book, about the league and the players and the things they could do and the things he wanted to. And he would make these grandiose statements that were far beyond what the league, what his football team, really were as far as being successful and the amount of fans he was bringing in and the amount of money and all that. And then you have Bob Matthews, right, who not only wanted to do this as a business venture and start a franchise, but he provided his players with anything. And Rose told me that, you know, he paid for their equipment, you know, he paid for their travel expenses. Initially they were getting a stipend, which was only like $25 a game, before taxes. He did that as long as he could. You know, he didn't want them to he wanted to treat them like, the athletes that they were and to be respected. He brought in excellent coaches to teach those who didn't really know the fundamentals, which were a lot because these women didn't start playing until later on in life, to really teach them the game and the ins and outs. And, you know, he cared. There was a level of care there. And even when he had to relinquish the LA Dandelions down the road, it was a hard thing for him to have to do, you know, because he had this vision. Like I said, he wanted to create a league that was akin to the NFL. And he didn't want the negative press. You know, he wanted these women to be respected. He was approached to do exhibition games with men's teams and personalities in LA, but wouldn't do it. I also think that hindered him a little bit because being so close to Hollywood, he could have really used that as a promotional and marketing tool that he never really did, unfortunately. But yeah, they just were two different men cut from, you know, two different cloths, but both very much a part of an important part of women's football history.
Lindsay, you know, I said we're going to circle back about some of the coverage, and you know, there's a lot of heroes in this story, but if there's villains to be named, it's a lot of the reporters, quite frankly, who when they did pay attention to this sport, this league, they did it with a lot of derision, and they did it with a lot of they couldn't seem to, you know, write a story and talk about these players without mentioning their weight or their looks or things like that. And that always seemed to be the focus of the coverage. It seems like they found it very difficult to be taken seriously. And I'm curious about that in the context of the LA Dandelions in particular, because you spent some time talking about, you know, kind of how they were marketed. And you talked about here how Bob Matthews wanted this to be taken very seriously as a product, even maybe to the detriment a little bit of where he didn't embrace some of these maybe opportunities to put the players out there in more Hollywood type settings and things like that. How frustrating was that to the players? It seems like there was no happy medium where they could be taken seriously as athletes, but also have their personalities put on display. It either had to be one or the other. It seems like they either had to be sexualized in some way, or they had to be dismissed completely as athletes. Was that as frustrating to them as it was to me reading it?
Oh, yes, incredibly. But at the same time, they sort of had to take what they could get, too, because a lot of these players saved newspaper clippings of these articles. And, you know, they weren't all like that, but they were far and few between. So it was just a hard position for them to be in. You know, you want to embrace being talked to by a reporter and, you know, it feels exciting. But at the same time, if they're asking you how you protect your breast, you know, time and time again, you know, that gets annoying after a while. And you want them to focus on the game itself. I think one of the first articles after the Dandelions debuted was just kind of the whole sentiment of the article, the game recap, was just kind of like, you know, they did better than we thought they would, kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of that, oh, they can play, surprise, that sort of lingered, but also, you know, the writers were male. And so they were viewing women playing football through that lens. And so there was a lot of nitpicking. There was a lot of, you know, like you said, focused on their looks. And it was the time period, right? That's basically what it comes down to, is if you look back at in the 1970s, you know, women playing football, and then it was just the time that this happened in, you know, where it was a negative experience.
Do you think it could have been different at all? I mean, were they just up against such a wave of all this stuff that you're talking about, just dismissiveness, and, you know, everybody wanted to reduce it to the common denominator of quote unquote women's lib. Was there anything that they, and I don't mean the players, I mean, you know, the people who organized the league and the owners and such, was there anything that they could have done to overcome that? Or was it just the tide of, like you said, the times?
I'll let Brittany jump in here. I feel like I've been hogging the microphone a little bit here.
No, that's okay. This is all the stuff that you know a lot better than me. Although I will say, I don't know that there was anything that they could have done, because when you talk to some of the players about the coverage, some of them actually said that reporters would just like wholesale make up quotes. They'll be like, no, I like literally never said that, or I never even talked to this person. Right. And media coverage as it still is today, which is a thing that I'm often critiquing, like as a journalist, media coverage is so filtered through the lens of the people who are writing the stories. And often the people that are writing the stories reflect societal power structures. And so what we are reading is what is a projection of, you know, what the writers think. And so from a reporting standpoint, actually for us, a very big challenge was that normally we rely on archival research and archival documents, and we assume that they're accurate. And maybe the box scores were accurate, but the representation of the players and the reality and even what they thought, when you're only being asked, what do you think of women's lib and how does your husband feel about you playing? And like, those are the only questions you get. Those are the only like quotes that we're going to have in the newspaper. And it's very hard to actually understand the perspective of the players. And so I think what's really interesting about this for us was we actually had to question the accuracy of our like source material, and could not rely on it in the way that you would hope that you would be able to.
And Brittany, I want to follow up with you on that, because there is such intentionality to this as you have written it. And you touched on it earlier at the top of this conversation. I think top of mind is the way that you both wrote about some of the things that are so football centric that we take as a truth of the sport, which is the interpersonal dynamics of dirty players, teams that get reputation for, you know, poking eyes at the bottom of the scrum or the bottom, you know, all of these things that, you know, broken fingers and, oh, you know, that like we talked about Rose Lowe tying her hair up because she had heard that the other team would yank it to try to tackle her. And these details that it's, again, when we contextualize the effort that went into writing this, and I'm wondering if you can expand on this further, it wasn't just, okay, this was written about in, you know, the AP, and so, oh, you pull that detail out because that's what it was. Instead, it's almost pushing through the societal structure of what it that the rep, the way that it was represented at the time, almost penetrating that and then reverting it into something that's so much more intentional, because you're talking about these women in the context of what they're doing, which is playing freaking football, right? And I'm wondering, I mean, that process, it sounds exhausting, first of all, but second of all, there is such an intentionality as writers that must have come from that.
Yeah, I think often about this newspaper article that criticized a game because it was low scoring. And the critique was that the teams had dominating defenses. And I was just like, I cannot imagine like a men's team being criticized for having good defense because they didn't see as many like touchdowns as they would have wanted to. And I think that's like really the double standard that these players were up against. But yeah, I think for us, part of the ability to like go back and talk to the players about like what they remember is that none of this reporting was done through their lens. And for us writing this book, we really wanted the book to be told through the lens of the people who played, while also bringing like from a writer's perspective or an author's perspective, this kind of larger narrative voice over the top that can contextualize all of the things into like the larger culture. So the players themselves are the micro details, the interpersonal part. And then us as authors come in and we add the kind of larger context to give it all meaning. And I think that was the goal through this entire process. And what's fascinating is, and I think so frustrating to both Lindsay and I, when we would read this coverage and then talk to the players, is how interesting they were on their own and how smart and perceptive and how much they had to say, and how great the coverage could have been if the reporters had just let the women be themselves the whole time, because they are interesting and like fascinating. And I think for me, one of the moments that you talk to them and I get chills is there were certain games that I would talk to players on both sides of. And one in particular is the game when the Toledo Troopers lose their first game. You know, it's the beginning of their sixth season and they've never lost a game, and they lose in overtime to the Oklahoma City Dolls. And I talked to players on both sides of that game, and they remember that last play, all of them. Like, I knew by the time like I had interviewed several players, I knew that they were going to tell me that it was a flea flicker play. And I knew that they were going to, like, how clear that is, how crisp that is, how much they could give you if you actually would let them. And I think that was some of the most frustrating parts of this. And so the ability to let them actually narrate that for us felt like a real gift and a real like correcting of the record.
It's such a universal truth throughout the dawn of time when people began throwing a ball around, as if you lose on a flea flicker, it irks you for the rest of your dang life.
Yeah. For sure. And yeah, Brittany, you being a very talented writer, you went exactly where I was going with this, which is it seems like as you look at the history of this, it's a lost opportunity, right? Because there were so many stories to tell. There were so many women in this league who they were not doing this to become famous. They were certainly not doing it to become wealthy, because they were only getting paid, some of them, $25 a game. And near the end there, some of them didn't even have teams, you know, took away workers' comp insurance because they were trying to save costs. They were literally putting their lives on the line line to play this game. I'm curious if both of you actually could join in, and maybe you have different memories or different answers here, but the players who stand out to you, because these go in different ways. I mean, you spend a lot of time talking about a player like Linda Jefferson, who's I'm guessing is a name that most of our listeners here probably have never heard of, but should. And then there's also a lot of, you know, I don't want to say smaller stories, but stories more about what these women went through, you know, who they were as people, why they decided to do this, their family situations. A couple you describe, their parents didn't even know they were playing until they saw them on TV. If I would love for each of you to just kind of weigh in and share if there's a particular player who you will take with you maybe for the rest of your lives.
Yeah, Justin. Go ahead.
A player who is mentioned in the book, you know, a little bit, but I actually connected with her towards the end, like during the fact-checking process. And so a lot of what she told me is not in the book, but a lot of it made an excerpt that we ran in Sports Illustrated when this book was published. Her name is Linda Stamps. And she was one of the founders of the Columbus Pacesetters. And I have gotten pretty close with her. She's one of those people, like each team had their like resident archivist who saved everything. And Linda was the Pacesetters version of that. And what I loved about Linda is that, you know, she grew up, she was a football obsessed kid. Like to hear her tell it, she would plan her Saturday chores around the NCAA game of the week. And the Pacesetters were one of the teams that started under Sid Friedman and felt very exploited and decided to like break off on their own. And they went under the ownership of the Toledo Troopers and eventually broke away from that as well. And, you know, Linda was one of the people who, organized. She comes from a labor organizing, housing organizing background, and was able to like band the team together. And they formed their own corporation and they bought the team from the men who owned them. And she talks about how as a woman during that time period, you didn't know what it was like to feel power over really anybody. And the first time she ever experienced the feeling of like having power over something happened on the field, and that she was able to translate the power that football gave her off the field to be able to purchase the team. And I think that was like such an incredible story. And, you know, when the Sports Illustrated piece ran, she texted me and was like, if you had told me as a little girl that I was going to be the daily cover of Sports Illustrated as a football player, like you made my lifelong dream come true. And I still think about that. But she still texts me during the football season. She would text me her takes on like all the games that were going on, and I didn't have the heart to tell her I didn't watch. But yeah. And Lindsay, I know, has different players that she spoke with.
Yeah. That's what's so great about having split the teams and getting, we got to know different players, and then we got to share those stories with each other, which was just added to the whole experience overall. But just to touch on your previous comment, just imagine how many feature profiles could have been written about all of these women at that time that were just missed opportunities. But yeah, Rose Lowe is obviously near and dear to my heart. She has become a friend, and you know, a lot of these women have become friends to us. But I wanted to talk about the Houston Hurricanes, because they were a player-owned team that was started by a woman named Marty Bryant, who was just at the dentist and happened to see Linda Jefferson on the cover of Women's Sports magazine and skimmed through it. It jumped out at her, the cover, obviously, and saw that there was a league and wanted to start a team. So, and she actually wrote the NWFL offices to see what she needed to do to start a team. They were looking to expand and add more teams. And they said, you know, go ahead, here's what you need to do to start. Obviously being player owned, Marty couldn't afford the expansion fee. So that was waived, I think, at the time, because they just wanted to add more teams to the league. But yeah, she just started this whole thing on a grassroots effort, talking to friends on her softball team, one of them being Billy Cooper, who was one of the best linebackers to play and played for the Hurricanes. And then they just started getting women showing up who were in the Houston area, who had moved there for a job and didn't know anybody, wanted to meet people, showed up to the tryout. There was one woman who was walking in the park who saw them trying out and decided to play. Another who was there just with some friends, and they called her over and was like, "Hey, you want to join up and play?" So it was just really great how their team came together. And the other side of that, though, is, you know, they were a pretty good team, but not as good as, say, the Toledo Troopers or their rivals, the Oklahoma City Dolls, who were very good. And the Houston Hurricanes would get pummeled by the Dolls every time they played them throughout their four season run. And just their goal became to beat the Dolls. And eventually they did. And it was great how they had the players recalled that happening and what went into the game and the strategy and how they were able to pull it off, and also how they felt about it afterwards. You know, it put this exclamation point on their tenure, that it was just, it's so great. And as Brittany said, just so rich to hear.
Well, and all these teams as well, communities are forming and being shaped by the people within them. And so, you know, as you both are journalists, you both are phenomenal writers and storytellers and also journalists. And so as you sort of unearth facets of the communities that you're studying here, what were some of the things that you found through reading the book? And I'm not going to give too much away, but there's some really great passages about sort of the connections and then also the disconnections by region. There's parts where some of the players are almost lamenting the fact that there's maybe not as much community because everyone's commuting, for example, maybe Los Angeles area teams or teams where the practice schedule has to be a little bit different. But then also in the middle of the country, you know, the teams that you both have just mentioned, building communities that they could not maybe find in other spaces. What did you find about that aspect of telling the story?
Yeah, I did not think that when I started researching the Dallas Blue Bonnets that I was going to end up down like a rabbit hole of Dallas lesbian bar history in the 1970s. But as a journalist and as a researcher, like, that's kind of, to me, one of the most exciting parts of this work. And it became clear very quickly as I started talking to players who had played in Dallas that there was no way to tell the story of that team without also talking about the history of the lesbian community at that time, and the connections between the team and the bars. There was like five at one point in Dallas. And, you know, we assume that there will be some players in the league that were queer. The question was whether they would want to talk about it or whether they saw it as connected to, you know, their time in the league at all. And, you know, in this case, and not everybody did see it as connected, but in Dallas, many of the women really did, because, you know, out of the bars, that was the only, really one of the only places at the time that they could like safely be out and openly gay. And those were their community centers. They organized softball leagues out of those bars. You know, they had steak and potato nights on Friday nights, and you bring your own steak and they would cook it for you. This was really their family. And so that's how a lot of these women found out that the league was, you know, happening. And they saw the ad in the paper and went to tryouts. And, you know, these bars also bought ad space in the programs. They supported the team. In many ways, the teams then became similar spaces to the bars, right? And I think it's really like important to think about marginalized communities throughout history have been very good at creating safe spaces in a hostile world. And this is another example of that. And so, you know, all teams had some aspect of that, and you can't dig into each one in that level of detail, and they were all like unique. But you know, for me, that was one community story that I was really excited to be able to tell and really make visible that part of the history.
Yeah, I loved how you got into some of the dynamics of that and how they were, you know, different even on each team, each roster, even each year sometimes. It's changed. And kind of as an offshoot of that, one thing I was curious about, because it got mentioned a couple times, but the relationship with the NFL. Because some of these teams, some of them were not playing in NFL mm-hmm. cities. Obviously, we talked a lot about the Toledo Troopers being a major part of the Oklahoma City Dolls. But you did have, you had Dallas, you had Detroit, you had Los Angeles, you had San Diego for a little bit of time there. You mentioned a couple times in the book how there would be, I don't want to mischaracterize it, but some type of rally or some type of, you know, brief public show of support. But how prevalent was that, if at all? What was the relationship between some of these NFL teams and these women's teams? Did it exist at all? And when you talk about missed opportunities there, was that a missed opportunity for the NFL to really promote that league?
Brief would be the key word there, brief okay. public showings. I think about, right, so the Dallas Blue Bonnets played in Texas Stadium, which was the, at the time, brand new Cowboys venue. And so, you know, for these women, too, to like run out onto the field at Texas Stadium where they literally watched their idols play on TV, they really felt like they had, you know, their dream was coming true. And it also felt like they were on the precipice of like this league being something, you know. I sometimes do think about how even though they would get like 3,000 or 4,000 people to a game, how measly that number would look in that venue. But the Cowboys did, from what I can tell, like the most to support their NWFL counterpart. And again, like the bar is like on the floor. So the players, the NWFL players, considered the Cowboys like they consider themselves a sister team. Probably if you asked the Cowboys themselves, they would maybe have not agreed. But they did a joint pep rally. And there was like a promotional photo in the newspaper of a former Cowboys player buying a ticket to a Blue Bonnets game. And aside from sharing the venue and that like one pep rally, there's not much evidence that there was ever any financial support or anything else. And in Detroit, the Detroit Demons played in hand-me-down practice jerseys from the Lions. And some of the players were invited to some Lions practices, I believe. But again, I can't see anything more concrete than that. That really happened in terms of like support. And the Lions hand-me-down jerseys ended up being worn by 4 different teams in the NWFL over 10 years. So that should tell you how the finances of the league were. They just kept getting passed from like team to team. Those were probably the biggest direct connections that we can find. Although, you know, Lindsay knows a little bit more about this than I do, but in, you know, Sid Friedman's teams, he hired former NFL players to coach. They were Black men who couldn't get jobs in the league. And that was, you know, Sid Friedman's way of trying to attract press and, you know, attention to his women's teams was by legitimizing them with NFL players attached as coaches.
Right. Right. You know, one thing, I'm sorry, this is a tangent, but it was one thing that kind of struck me a couple times in the book is you make mention of the LA coach, Bob Edwards, being possibly the first Black head coach in pro football history. And there's a couple references to that, either to him or to other Black coaches who couldn't find work in the NFL. Was that prevalent, or was that by design at all? Or did that just kind of happen because they were opportunities and these were qualified people who just weren't getting opportunities elsewhere? It strikes me as that's a little bit of a tangent here, but it struck me as maybe a little bit piece of history that I don't think a lot of people are aware of.
Yeah, it was opportunities, basically. Yeah. If the NFL was going to not give Black coaches a chance or an opportunity to coach, well, they wanted a coach. And so they took the opportunities where presented. But also, you know, it just speaks to the fact that women's leagues are often, not often, but they are just the more progressive, more evolved leagues. And, you know, it's shown that throughout history, and the NWFL is just another example. You had gay and straight players playing on the same team. You had, like you just mentioned, black coaches. Eventually there were women coaches who jumped from playing to coaching the teams. And then further on, later in the years, when after the league folded and other women's football leagues popped up in the late 1999 was the first time it was revisited again. And since then, women have owned these football teams. So just a really groundbreaking league when you take a look at all of these societal things that were just so impactful and not really discussed.
And these women were trailblazers in so many ways, and they were changing history in so many ways. But at the same time, and you both did a great job of detailing all of the many, many nuances and reasons why through this book, you know, at the same time, there was a tendency, again, by the press, mostly, to almost be reductive in assigning them what their meaning was as it correlated specifically to, you know, women's lib and all of that. But there was so much more nuance to it, to the point where some of them at the time were also not wanting to identify as associates of that movement in particular. And I wonder, first of all, if we can unpack that a little bit, but then also as you revisited these conversations with many of these women, what they felt about what they now know their context was and is in history.
Yeah, I think what was interesting for us as we read the newspaper coverage, right, was how often women's lib was mentioned. And the players were very quick to write it off. And the reporters were just as quick to draw the connections. And I think that it's really easy to like look back from current day and be like, oh, well, the 1970s, second wave feminism, women's football, obviously these things are connected. And I don't think they're not connected. I think that there was a cultural moment and societal shift in which women doing, taking on roles or doing things that were like traditionally for men or that they had been historically kept out of was becoming normalized, right? And so I think that it's probably not a coincidence that we end up with, you know, a women's football league and that maybe the cultural conversation created the space for that to happen. But like on an interpersonal level, I think it's really easy to make people parts of movements. And I think that flattens history in some way, because if you look at what second wave feminism was about, it was a very white feminism. It was a very middle-class feminism. It was a very domestic feminism that was based in like getting women into the workplace and like things about like housework and childcare. And if you look at who's playing in the NWFL, like many of these women are working class. They've had to work. Many of them were gay and didn't have a husband at home or kids. And so it didn't necessarily speak to the day-to-day like lived experience that they had. And at the same time, you know, we call them unwitting activists in the book, because as much as you can try to distance yourself from a political movement, the fact is that like change doesn't just happen on a picket line or like in an organizing meeting. We move society forward. Change happens because somebody stands up and says, I'm going to do this thing that I'm told that I'm not allowed to do. And that's what these women did. They wanted to play football and they did it. And just that act alone broke barriers and changed like changed history. And so they deserve credit for that.
Yeah, there's a line in here. I think it was early in the book. Sorry, I just have this long page of notes that I kept. And there was a quote in there, and I apologize. I don't know whether it was one of you who wrote it directly or was a quote, but it says, change happens because everyday people refuse to cave to societal expectations. And that was something that kind of carried me throughout this book and in hearing about these women. Do you think, and again, I know this is not universal, but do you think that the way that they process that has changed over the last 40 years? Do they see themselves the same way that they did in the late 1970s?
I think it depends on the woman.
Yeah.
there are some who will look back and say, I see now. And I wouldn't have called myself a feminist then, but I consider myself to be one now, or I still wouldn't use the word feminist, but I like can see the barriers that I broke. So for me, that was my experience. Linz, did you have people that had different takes on that?
I think what they realize now, not so much on the feminist topic, but what they did was kind of groundbreaking and sort of paved the way for the women's leagues that we see today, and sort of, you know, planted the seed for that growth of women's sports to really take hold and evolve over the past four decades. So I think they understand that now. And that's one of the reasons why I think a lot of them were willing to talk and wanting to talk, because they see that, you know, what they did was important.
Yeah. And, the title of the book, again, Hail Mary, the Rise and Fall of the National Women's Football League. And the brilliance of this book is the way that you weave in those interpersonal stories, but also talk about the league and some of the challenges that it went through. And rise and fall is the perfect way to describe it. And one of the things that struck me was how you mentioned later in the book how, you know, you look at the NFL, and the early years of the NFL were a disaster. In finance, and the number of teams that went in and out, and how loose the structure was, and everything else. But the difference being that that the men's leagues have traditionally been given a lot more rope in ways of sustainability. I mean, I even think as recently as, you know, Major League Soccer started in the mid 1990s and went through a long period of time where it didn't seem, you know, it seemed questionable for a while, would it make it, would it not? But because it was so well supported by billionaires and by advertisers and TV money, it was given that time to grow and to ultimately succeed. A league like this, and as you describe, a lot of women's leagues are not given that opportunity. Rose Lowe, there was a quote in there about Rose, from Rose Lowe, saying that we were too early. And what how did you take that? If this league had come around 10 years later, would it have worked long term, or were there just such flaws? You talk about the lack of a centralized structure. You talk about, you know, trying to grow too quickly. Was there anything that could have made this sustainable over a long period of time, or were there just too many factors working against it?
Well, just to answer your first question about Rose's quote, I think she meant that basically saying that we were too early was that she's looking at the women's sports landscape now and just how much growth has happened and just where women athletes are at in this day and age, and then comparing that to when their football league started, and so there's that, you know, kind of comparison going on. But I don't know necessarily think they were too early. I mean, it kind of happened at the right time and the right place, you know, when everything was happening with Title IX and all of that, you know, and just women sort of going through the feminist movement, whether they knew it or not as players, you know, it was just all part of that. It was kind of like the perfect setting, and then jumping off of, you know, Sid Friedman's creation and taking it a step further. You know, I think it just happened as it was supposed to. So, but yeah, I can see, you know, there's some regret there, I think, because they look at it like it was a failure when in actuality, like, it was just something that was pretty great that existed for, you know, from 1974 to 1988. And at its height was, you know, a lot of fun and, you know, such a great experience for them. And I don't want, you know, Rose to feel like, you know, like that she failed at something, which I told her, you know, all of this. But, you know, it was the owners really who just were short-sighted and weren't looking in the long term. You know, men's leagues throughout history have been afforded two main luxuries, and that's money and that's time. Right. And for whatever reason, well, we know why, but women's leagues just are not given that same investment in capital or in time. And the owners just, when they started the league, they went about it in the wrong way. They were expecting a return on investment right away. They're expecting it to catch on and turn into the to a NFL type of thing sooner than it really could. And there was also the fact that the teams they started with were not in close proximity to each other, where they could really have, you know, interleague play. You know, right. Travel costs were a big issue. Banking on the fact that the novelty would last, you know, and then fans would come who were curious, but then that curiosity wears off. And we also saw that with the media coverage. At first, there was a lot, but as we went into our research into the later years, when you got into the 1980s, late 70s, 1980s, you know, the articles were sparse and few and far between. It just became the novelty wore off, like I said. So there were a lot of things, the lack of promotion, the lack of marketing, the lack of being smart with the finances. It all went into it. And just the lack of really slugging through those hard initial years to begin with, where you're not going to make money, you're going to lose money. And just thinking, well, you know, this is it, instead of giving it time to really grow.
And before we close, my question for you both, and it's not going to be a simple answer, of course, but where does women's football go next? We see the rise of flag football and 7-on-7 leagues. We see players who are getting recruitment offers and playing at a community college or, FBS, FCS and FBS level at this point. And still, there are still obviously too many firsts, I think, but what happens next and where do want to and passion from young women as they grow up and love football, where can that meet the structure of making this possible for them?
I see like two main things when we talk about what's facing women's football today. One, I think, is a broader question that is facing the game of football as a whole around, traumatic brain injury and the safety of the sport. And whether anyone should be playing the game as it's designed currently, and whether, gender equality, in a sport that maybe needs an overhaul for itself, like how that fits and where the line of like overly paternalistic trying to protect women and like letting them take informed risk with, you know, their bodies comes in. And I think that that's a question that football as a whole is really going to have to grapple with. The other thing about the, women's football as it exists right now is there's so many leagues and they're not under like a centralized group, right? There's several that are doing their own thing. And I think there are some people that want the NFL to kind of step in and start a women's league and support that way. And there's others who are like, there's all of these problems with this league that was designed for men. And it's just like putting a men's league on top of a women's league, really the answer we can see with like the abuse scandals that the NWSL is facing now, that sometimes structures that were designed for men should not just be, applied directly to women's leagues. And that's something that the women's teams and leagues and the people who are playing the women's game right now is really having to ask themselves is what does it look like for us to come together under like one league, and how do we do that? And I think the community has a lot of like disagreements about what that looks like right now. And that's a big question facing the women's game.
I also just received a timely email today in regards to this question from Sam Gordon's camp, who came to popularity because she was an incredible youth football player, a girl playing on a boys squad, and videos of her went viral. And she's like, I want to say in her early 20s now, or maybe late teens, but she started a Utah girls tackle football league in her home state. And is now, I just got this email about her joining with Under Armour and starting football camps and creating the first ever women's football cleats. Which is so cool because you don't think about, women's football equipment having to be different, but obviously, there are some things that do need to be different, such as, your foot size and everything like that. But it's just cool. It's cool seeing that, there is a future that's there and that where women's football can still evolve, whether or not we're ever going to see a pro league one single pro league that catches on. I don't know. You know, there's this whole view still that women playing football, this violent sport, you know, this masculine code sport, is hard. It's a hurdle for society at large to get over, I think. You know, basketball, soccer, kind of different finesse sports that's maybe easier to come around to. But yeah, the future is there. The future's, you know, bright, I guess you could say. And, you know, you have people like Sam Gorin who want to continue to grow the sport, and it's great to see.
Also, you saying that she is now in her late teens or early 20s made me feel older than I have felt in a while.
Sorry about that.
But Lindsay, Brittany, thank you both, first of all, for your work, and second, for taking so much time with us today. Listeners, subscribers, you can follow Brittany on Twitter at BRITNIDLC. You can follow Lindsay on Twitter at DARCANGEL21. And of course, you can pick up their fantastic book, Hail Mary, The Rise and Fall of the National Women's Football League, pretty much wherever books are sold, which congratulations on that, first of all. And second of all, if you can find a way to support your local bookseller, please do so. But these, it's a phenomenal read. And thank you so much for this insightful and wonderful conversation today.
Yeah. I just add one last little tidbit that has an LA please. Dandelions tie for you guys. There was a player on the LA Dandelions named Barbara Patton, who was an incredible linebacker. She was a mother of two, and she used to bring her kids to practices with her. She couldn't afford childcare. She used to bring her nieces and nephews as well to practices and games. And her son, Marfkis, grew up watching her play, and he ended up becoming a professional football player himself, a linebacker for the Buffalo Bills. He also played for the Kansas City Chiefs and the Washington Commanders. He played for 13 seasons, I believe. So it's a cool little tie just to, you know, show that, you know, mm-hmm. kids can look up to their athlete parents, you know, whether it's a woman or a guy, and just, you know, learn the sport and become engrossed in the sport. It's just a whole twist on that. And I just kind of love that story.
Yeah, there's so much in here. It's a history lesson. It's a great storytelling. And then there's things in here that should make you angry too about this story. So really appreciate the way as a writer, I was reading it through. Man, that the process of writing this must have been so fascinating, and putting it all together the way that you did, weaving the narrative. So congratulations on that, first of all. And yeah, again, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.